Good evening and welcome to the extended Friday edition of the KRFP Evening Report for February 16th, 2024. On today's show, the ability of local governments to have mask rules during the next pandemic could have existential consequences. We'll hear some of the debate in an Idaho legislative committee this week. Also, we'll hear from librarians and others about the newest library bill seeking to shield minors from harmful material. That's now before the legislature. All of that coming up on the KRFP Evening Report, but first, world headlines from FSN and a roundup of regional news.
From Feature Story News in San Francisco, I'm Ira Spitzer. A New York judge has ordered that Donald Trump pay over $350 million in damages after finding the former U.S. president liable for fraud. After a marathon court case, Judge Arthur Engoron also barred Trump from doing business in New York. FSN's Jody Jacobs reports from New York.
The lawsuit brought by New York Attorney General Letitia James accused the former president and his sons of repeated and persistent fraud that included falsifying business records and financial statements to get better bank loans. The order by the judge here in New York comes after repeated denials by Donald Trump, even labeling the case a political vendetta. The former president still has to answer to four other criminal cases, including one here in New York related to hush money payments ahead of the 2016 election. This is the second judgment against Trump this year. Last month, he was hit with an $83 million verdict in the defamation case against him. Jody Jacobs, New York.
U.S. President Joe Biden says his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin is responsible for the death of Russia's opposition leader Alexei Navalny. In a press conference at the White House, Biden said he's outraged but not surprised by the news, though he stopped short of calling it an assassination. Navalny died aged 47 on Friday in an Arctic Circle penal colony, according to the country's prison service. He was poisoned before being arrested and prosecuted in Russia and was serving 19 years in jail on extremism charges that are viewed by many Western nations as politically motivated. FSN's Benji Heyer reports.
Joe Biden years ago vowed there'd be devastating consequences for Vladimir Putin if Navalny died in captivity. Consequences he insists Russia's already faced as it deals with the toll of its war on Ukraine and Western sanctions. But Biden warns his administration is still looking at a whole number of options to punish Mr. Putin and, quote, his thugs following Navalny's death, which Biden said is proof of Putin's brutality. The US president hailed Alexei Navalny, paying tribute to someone he called a brave, principled, powerful voice for the truth, even from behind bars, a man who stood up to the, quote, bad things Putin did. Mr. Biden also urged lawmakers here to pass a bill in Congress to provide aid for Ukraine as it continued to defend itself against what he described as a vicious onslaught from Russia. Benji Haya, Washington.
And a former FBI informant has been charged with lying about Joe Biden and his son's alleged business dealings with a Ukrainian company. Republican lawmakers in December moved to impeach the president on claims that he personally benefited from Hunter Biden's business ventures. If convicted, Alex Smirnov faces the possibility of 25 years behind bars. From Bureaus Worldwide, this is FSN.
Those who follow American politics have likely heard some candidates claim the 2024 elections could be critical for America to remain a democracy. But one conservative group has taken it a step further and published a plan for what some call a government takeover. The Heritage Foundation's Project 2025 is a detailed plan for the next Republican president to eliminate or transform agencies that enforce civil rights laws. Carrie Baker, a professor of American Studies at Smith College, writes in Ms. Magazine this month that a key part of the plan is to future-proof the changes so they can't easily be undone.
What usually happens is a Republican government gets in and puts in place certain policies, and then a Democratic government wins and they reverse some of those policies. What this report is setting out is a strategy to make conservative policies permanent.
Baker says the Heritage Foundation targets what it calls the totalitarian cult, known today as the Great Awakening. Potential changes to such agencies as the CDC, EPA, Health and Human Services, and the Department of Education. The Heritage Society did not respond to a request for comment on the report. Baker says the coalition paints a dystopian vision of a GOP administration, in addition to the 887-page policy agenda, he has developed a presidential personnel database of vetted conservatives and founded a Presidential Administration Academy to train loyal bureaucrats. He adds the material labels Democrats as Marxists, socialists, communists, and cultural elites. Baker points out the Heritage Foundation and many of the organizations in the coalition are led and funded by billionaire capitalists, such as the Koch brothers. She says much of the funding for the alliance comes from so-called dark money PACs, where the funds are difficult or impossible to trace.
I think the most important issue is democracy. Are we going to still have a democracy or not? Are we going to have a functioning federal government, a federal government that's actually functioning for the people rather than for the super wealthy? Because that's what they want.
For United States News Service, I'm Mark Richardson.
A new poll finds in Arizona an overwhelming majority believes increasing the number of adults with college degrees, certificates, and credentials would help many people reach a better quality of life and prevent economic hardships. Rich Nickel heads Education Forward Arizona, the group that commissioned the poll. He adds most Arizonans support the Achieve 60 AZ goal of at least 60% of working-age adults completing education beyond high school by the year 2030.
So what that means is for the state to reach that goal, we need to produce about 500,000 new degrees, certificates, and credentials over the next 6 years or so.
Nickel says currently the state is hurtling toward what he calls an attainment cliff, with fewer than half of Arizona students continuing their education after high school. But he calls it remarkable that 86% of Arizona voters across the spectrum support the Achieve 60 AZ goal and encourages policymakers to view education as a solution, not a problem, in their funding decisions. Nickel says over 90% of Arizona voters support what he calls practical policy suggestions. These include expanding access to technical training and higher ed pathways during high school that can lead to a credential and more dual enrollment options that allow teens to earn college credit.
Because it's going to give students, number one, the belief that they can do post-secondary work, but also give them a head start on those important credits, which in the end help make post-secondary education, you know, more affordable because it's less time to the degree.
Nickel adds there also are benefits for Arizona's economy. His group found increasing the number of people who continue their education beyond high school by 20% would result in an additional $5 billion a year to the state's economy. Nickel says his group has put together the Arizona Education Progress Meter, a tool to show what it will take to reach the Achieve 60 AZ goal based on 8 indicators.
We've set out where we should be if we want to be competitive nationally as far as the goals. And then we also keep track on a yearly basis where we actually are. If you were to look at those metrics, we are not where we need to be.
For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez. Support for this reporting was provided by Lumina Foundation. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
It goes like this, the fourth, the fifth, minor, fall.
On that last note.
Something hallelujah.
Now hold it a little higher. Gotta go off key now.
Hallelujah.
Yes! Now you're ready for the karaoke gong show. Now really screech it out. That way KRFP makes more money.
Bad karaoke night.
The musical game of musical chairs without the chairs. Pay to sing a song. Pay double to stop a song. Saturday, February 17th, Mikey's Heroes, 7 p.m.
And live in the KRFP studios in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartas, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. Boise police raided the Idaho Harm Reduction offices in Boise Tuesday, looking for items pertaining to the use of methamphetamine, opioids, and crack cocaine. Harm reduction projects have opened across the country and around the world in recent years as a counterpoint to punitive war on drugs policies and as a way to help addicts who may need clean syringes so they don't get hepatitis or AIDS. The Idaho Harm Reduction Project says on its website it is involved in a set of practical strategies and ideas aimed at reducing negative consequences associated with drug use. The website says harm reduction is also a movement for social justice built on a belief in and respect for the rights of people who use drugs. The Idaho Press reports the Boise Police Department said syringes were not part of the search warrant. Police also raided the Idaho Harm Reduction Project's Caldwell offices. Idaho Harm Reduction Project said on Instagram this week the Idaho Health and Welfare Department knew about their public health work and they are looking forward to getting the issue resolved. In a statement, Health and Welfare Director Dean Cameron wrote, "The department does not condone or support the use of illegal drugs or those who profit from it. Substance use has a pervasive and devastating impact on Idaho families and children. The department supports all efforts to protect Idahoans from the impacts of illicit drug use." The Idaho Fish and Game Commission voted yesterday to oppose three bills now before the legislature. The commission voted unanimously to give the thumbs down to a bill that would give highly prized mountain goat, bighorn sheep, or moose tags as an award to hunters that kill wolves. Currently, Idaho Fish and Game each year only issues 541 bull moose tags, 83 Rocky Mountain bighorn sheep tags, 12 California bighorn sheep tags, and 41 mountain goat tags. Fish and Game Department Legislative and Community Engagement Coordinator Ellery Tucker Williams said, should Senate Bill 1340 be enacted, there would be minimal tags left for non-outfitted hunters, and the odds of drawing one of these few remaining tags would decrease further. In some areas, it is likely that 100% of these highly coveted tags would go to outfitters. If the commission decided to provide additional tags above what was proposed by Fish and Game to satisfy the provisions of Senate Bill 1340, it would almost certainly result in over-harvest of these three species. The Fish and Game Commission also voted to oppose Senate Bill 1345, which would prevent law enforcement officers, including Idaho conservation officers, from entering private property without permission from the owner, a search warrant, probable cause of a crime, or an emergency situation. The bill has exceptions allowing officers to enter private property to dispatch wounded animals or to carry out their duties, such as serving notices. Sponsors of the bill are Republican Senator Kelly Anthon of Burley, Republican Senator Jim Guthrie of McCammon, and Democratic Senator James Rookte of Pocatello. The Lewiston Tribune reports a U.S. Supreme Court case in 1924 established a precedent in which it said, unlike homes and their immediate surroundings, privately owned open fields and forests are not afforded protections against warrantless searches. The Supreme Court justices decided those properties do not adhere to the persons, houses, papers, and effects language of the Fourth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. Several states do have constitutions that protect open fields from warrantless searches or have passed laws to protect open fields. The commission also opposed House Bill 536, which would make several changes to state law, ultimately weakening the Department of Agriculture's program designed to keep chronic wasting disease and other wildlife diseases from infecting elk farms or from spreading the chronic wasting disease to wild deer and elk populations. The sponsor of that bill is Republican Representative Gerald Raymond of Minan. And you're listening to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman.
Programming on KRFP is sponsored by the Moscow Food Co-op, specializing in food, goods, and programs that nourish and nurture our community. The Moscow Food Co-op is located at 121 East 5th Street. For more information, visit moscowfood.coop, call 882-8537, or find them on Facebook.
The Idaho House Health and Welfare Committee voted unanimously yesterday to approve a bipartisan bill legalizing fentanyl test strips. Idaho is one of six states that still outlaw testing strips for controlled substances because they're considered paraphernalia. The co-sponsors are Republican Marco Erickson of Coeur d'Alene and House Minority Leader Elena Rubel of Boise. Many street drugs are laced with fentanyl, which can be deadly in extremely small amounts. According to the Idaho Press, Erickson said, "This is not paraphernalia, this is a life-saving measure." Rubel cited a study in Delaware that found 47% of drug users supplied with fentanyl strips took harm reduction actions, such as using a smaller dose of the drug they had on hand. Fentanyl-related deaths in Idaho tripled between 2020 and 2022, when the state had 188 fentanyl overdose deaths. Rubel said, "This will be just very helpful for people to be able to cheaply and easily make sure they aren't being inadvertently poisoned by fentanyl." Three members of the public spoke on the bill in committee, all in favor. One was from the ACLU of Idaho, and two were college students. Associated Students of University of Idaho Legislative Affairs Director Martha Smith said, "Growing up in Kooski, there was a lot of substance abuse." Smith said, "As a young person in the state, I worry about the people who I grew up with back home. I worry about people I go to school with." House Bill 441 now heads to the full House. The committee vote on fentanyl strips came the same day the state Senate approved a bill establishing mandatory minimum sentences for fentanyl trafficking. Under Idaho law, a person can be convicted of trafficking for possessing a certain amount of a drug, even if the prosecutors do not show there was intent to distribute the drug. The lowest minimum sentence under House Bill 441 is 3 years in jail and a $10,000 fine for possessing 4 grams of fentanyl or substances with detectable traces of fentanyl. Republican Senator Todd Lakey of Nampa sponsored the bill in the Senate. The bill also adds the crime of drug-induced homicide to Idaho Code. The law would apply if someone gives another person a drug that they die from. The maximum penalty would be life in prison and a $25,000 fine. The vote on the bill was 28-7. Senate Minority Leader Melissa Wintrow of Boise was one of those who voted against the bill because it could severely impact people struggling with addiction who are not necessarily dealing. The Idaho Press reports the only Republican to vote against the bill in the Senate was Phil Hart of Kellogg. On Wednesday, Hart made a motion to send the bill back to committee to amend the fiscal note to say increasing the number of prisoners will cost the state money. That motion failed on a 42-11 vote. Hart said every person he met with in a drug recovery program had at one time possessed enough pills to be charged with trafficking. He said, "These were people who were just personally using the drug and not trafficking." Senator Wintrow said she met with convicted fentanyl traffickers in a women's prison, and 13 out of 14 said they were not dealing when they were arrested for trafficking. Senate Bill 406 now heads to the governor's desk. The federal government has fallen behind on giving colleges financial aid information on next year's college students, which has caused the University of Idaho to delay sending out financial aid awards. University of Idaho Vice President for Strategic Enrollment Management, Dean Collar, told the Daily News the UI has changed the deadline for students to accept financial aid scholarships for the fall semester from May 1st to June 1st. The problem stems from the federal government redesigning its free application for federal student aid forms, which are used to determine how much financial aid a high school graduate needs to attend college. The redesign meant the forms that would normally be available in the fall were not available until the end of December. Collar said UI officials are concerned students will choose not to attend college if they don't know if they can afford it. University of Idaho Financial Aid Services Director Randy Coyle said the school manages more than $90 million in federal student aid and other scholarships each year. Coyle said her office is reaching out to students and visiting high schools to let high school seniors know about the situation.
Parents often struggle to secure after-hours child care. Advocates want the Washington State Legislature to increase incentives for businesses to provide this service. The Department of Children, Youth, and Families is requesting funds to increase the bonus to $500 a month for facilities that provide care before 6 a.m., after 6 p.m., and on the weekends. Alejandra Alarcon owns three Spanish immersion daycare facilities east of Seattle. She says it's hard to find people to work non-traditional hours.
Handling the expenses and the payroll and all the things that we need to have for running the daycare and can give the service that the families need.
Lawmakers are expected to release their budgets next week. The legislative session ends March 7th. Genevieve Stokes with Child Care Aware of Washington says parents who work in the service industry, hospitals, or agriculture, for instance, often struggle to find care for their kids.
So that's left a lot of parents scrambling to figure out alternative options that might not be what their preferred option would be if they had available high-quality care.
Stokes says the state has made a lot of investments in child care, but adds the industry is struggling, and full-time care on average costs more than tuition to the University of Washington, which is more than $11,000 a year.
We're in sort of a bind here. The non-standard hours exacerbates that, but this is true across the board that providers can't afford to provide the care and parents can't afford to pay more for it.
For Washington News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
KRFP thanks its listeners and supporters, including the Palouse Folklore Society, celebrating traditional music and dance on the Palouse since 1982. The Palouse Folklore Society sponsors concerts, jam sessions, and a monthly contra dance. Find out more at palousefolk.org or on Facebook.
National testing business Quest Diagnostics is making a new blood test for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, or PFAs, available for West Plains residents near Spokane who may have been sickened by the dangerous chemicals, PFAs, which had been seeping into the local groundwater for decades. West Plains residents became aware of PFAs in the groundwater in 2017, but many do not know if the chemical has entered their bodies. According to the spokesman review, Quest Diagnostics says the service is a step towards improved access for patients considered high risk. The tests cost $306 and are not covered by insurance plans, so people who want to be tested have to pay for the tests out of pocket. Quest Diagnostics Drug Monitoring and Toxicology Director Dr. Jack Kane said after someone purchases a test, they recommend the purchaser use either the Spokane Patient Services Testing Facility at 601 West 5th Avenue in Spokane or the Coeur d'Alene Testing Center at 920 Ironwood Drive to analyze the results. In a statement, Kane said, scientists and the general public are increasingly aware that PFAs may be dangerous to human health, but access to quality, convenient testing to assess exposure is limited. West Plains Water Coalition President John Hancock said the cost of the PFA tests may be prohibitive to many residents there. Hancock said the poverty rate on the West Plains overall is around 30%. Hundreds of dollars for either well testing or blood testing is beyond the reach of many families. PFAs is a problem they didn't cause, and the solutions are far beyond individual choice. Public attention and truth-telling is required to admit the realities of the trouble toward big community actions to solve it. An important side benefit of the PFAS test for West Plains residents is the test also screens people for perfluorooctanoic acid. That class of chemicals, called PFOAs, is under the PFAS category and is a common ingredient in firefighting foam. The chemicals are widely used, so most people have at least some level of PFAS in their bodies. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Protection, people with elevated levels of the chemical in their systems may experience increases in cholesterol, kidney or testicular cancer, high blood pressure, changes in liver enzymes, lower antibody response to certain vaccines, and decreases in birth weights. Quest Diagnostics said reasons for high levels of PFAS include exposure to the chemical at industrial jobs such as firefighting, water supply coming from places close to a commercial or industrial location that may have PFAS, including airports, military bases, manufacturing plants, sewage facilities, and people living near a chemical manufacturing facility or environments already known to be contaminated with PFAS. Soldiers at Fairchild Air Force Base, located on the West Plains, have been using firefighting foam with PFAS for years during training exercises. MultiCare Rockwood Clinic Primary Care Medical Director Dr. Sarah Dulst said the first thing people should do is speak with their primary care physician, who may have the knowledge and experience to provide guidance or order the blood work themselves. In a statement, Dulst said, "We encourage patients to have an initial conversation with their primary care provider before ordering lab tests. Often the results of these tests can be difficult to interpret without the counseling and guidance of a medical expert." Providence Health issued a statement saying, "People concerned about exposure to PFAS should talk with their healthcare provider, who can provide personalized guidance based on an individual's health history and potential exposure risk." Kane said, "Since Quest Diagnostics is operated by doctors, they can discuss individual test results with patients over the phone." The Idaho Legislature's Joint Finance Appropriations Committee voted Wednesday to provide the Department of Agriculture with $11.6 million to fight invasive quagga mussel infestations. State employees discovered quagga mussels for the first time in the state last year in the Snake River near Twin Falls. The Department of Agriculture in October used a copper-based chemical on a 16-mile stretch of the Snake River to wipe out the quagga mussel infestation. They also, by necessity, killed many fish. Ag Department officials say they hope they've killed all the mussels, but they won't know until the weather warms so they can resume testing. Governor Brad Little recommended lawmakers approve the $11.6 million when he presented his proposed fiscal year 2025 budget last month. Ag Department Director Chanel DeWalt told lawmakers Wednesday the department would use the new funding to pay for two new full-time positions and 18 temporary positions as the department seeks to double its water monitoring and sampling and increase the number of hot wash stations to clean boats that may have brought mussels from out of state. And you're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow Pullman.
KRFP thanks its listeners and sponsors, including Tie-Dye Everything, with locally made tie-dyed items, incense, and other accessories. Tie-Dye Everything is located near 6th Street at 527 South Main Street in Moscow. For more information, you can find Tie-Dye Everything at tie-dye-everything.com.
And you're listening to the KRFP Evening Report, special Friday extended edition on KRFP Moscow Pullman. We now turn to the first of our featured segments. On Valentine's Day, the Idaho House State Affairs Committee voted for a local preemption bill that may make it harder for local governments and health districts to save the lives of people you love. Idaho was one of the states most resistant to physical distancing, temporary business closures, and mask ordinances as the pandemic swept through in early 2020, long before vaccines were available. Longtime Idaho resident Eamon Bundy, whereabouts unknown, who the Ramparts Group concluded was involved in domestic terrorism for helping organize the armed Malheur National Wildlife Refuge takeover in Central Oregon in 2016, also managed to organize the largest anti-mask pressure group in the U.S. from his previous home in rural Idaho. He and his supporters physically barged into health board public meetings that were being held on Zoom, forcing their cancellation, broke things, and carried long guns into the state capitol during the special legislative session in August 2020 and shut down busy emergency rooms in Boise for a time, claiming Child Protective Services had kidnapped the emaciated infant grandchild of Bundy's close associate Diego Rodriguez, which law enforcement took to the hospital for treatment for a couple of days. Despite Bundy's disappearance last year after being ordered to pay $5.8 million to St. Luke's hospital system for months of defamation and harassment of its employees, he has a lot of supporters in Idaho government. New Attorney General Raul Labrador, for one, who meddled in the case of Diego Rodriguez shortly after he was sworn into office this year. Also, numerous Idaho legislators on the far right are supporters of Amon Bundy's brand of politics. Lawmakers have been trying every year since Governor Little's temporary lockdown to handcuff state government, local governments, including school districts and regional health districts, from deploying mask mandates. This year, they're trying again. On Wednesday, the House State Affairs Committee voted to send the local preemption bill to ban mask mandates to the House floor. Republican Representative Jason Gallagher of Weezer sponsored House Bill 493. The local preemption bill exempts healthcare facilities and vocational settings where face masks are, quote, an integral and compulsory safety component of required job duties. We're going to play some of the debate and testimony in the House State Affairs Committee from Wednesday. Some of the people you will hear are solidly in the far-right camp with all the reality challenges you might expect. We'll start with Representative Jason Gallagher of Weezer introducing House Bill 493 that would ban local and statewide mask mandates with the exceptions of healthcare facilities and vocational settings.
Good morning, Madam Chairman and committee. So we have before you House Bill 493, and here we go again. So this legislation is to prevent any political subdivisions, and there is a definition for that in the bill. Means any county, city, public health district, school district, special purpose district, or other district or municipality organized under any general or specific law of the state. But it does not include any hospital or healthcare facility. So this is a legislation to prohibit any city, state, county political subdivision from mandating mask wearing. This does not limit anyone's ability to wear a mask if that's what they so choose to do for themselves. This is a, a personal sovereignty bill, freedom bill, health freedom, to make your own decisions, your own health decisions. So there were concerns about I'll give you an example. If there is a government employer who employs painters that go around and paint buildings, office buildings, etc., and they need to wear a mask in order to do their job safely so they're not breathing in fumes, that is exempt from this. So it does say in here the exemption is strictly limited to those working in roles where face masks are an integral and compulsory safety component of required job duties. So if there's a welder, for example, they have to wear a mask. So that's exempt from this. This really is pointed, as we all know, because this has come before you before and passed, and it has passed overwhelmingly on the House floor as well in previous years. And this year, bringing it back, we have addressed the concerns of the people. And this is a people's bill. This is the people's bill. The people want this. protecting their own, making their own choices. I think that's it. So I'm going to yield the rest of my time over to the great senator from District 13, I believe, Senator Lenny.
Senator Lenny, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Brian Lenny from the great city of Nampa in Canyon County, one of Idaho's shining gems. So trust the science. We heard that for years and years and years. Follow the data. Listen to the experts. It feels like just yesterday we were living in the midst of the COVID crisis. And although there were several missteps, I believe, looking back, that most of us were just trying to do the best we could with the information we had. It's kind of our first COVID crisis. But as we sit here today in 2024, it's crystal clear to me, and I think to probably most of us in this room, if we admit it, that much of our COVID response was unscientific, unjustified, and frankly absurd. We saw medical coercion, social distancing, moms being arrested in parks, snipers on the roof of our Central District Health building during a public meeting, and forced masking also top the list of those absurdities. And under the heavy hand of the CDC and Dr. Anthony Fauci, the science we were we were obsessed with forcing not just free thinking adults, but even toddlers as young as 2 years old to wear face masks. And we all remember those chilling videos of adults forcing crying children to wear masks in schools. Mostly we saw those. We all lived through it. We're here 4 years back. We're here in 2024 looking back. But, you know, I remember the shaming, the gaslighting, and the paranoia on both sides of every debate that had to do with COVID was almost palpable. It's almost tangible. And although many of us suspected it at the time, new research has now proven what we thought all along, that much of this was pointless, especially the forced masking. I have three examples of that. In a congressional hearing just 3 months ago on restoring trust in science in Congress in D.C., CDC Director Mandy Cohen evaded questions on whether she would bring back mask mandates. 6 days later, in December 2023, a BMJ journal, medical journal, published a study that found, quote, mask recommendations are not supported by scientific evidence. Third one, the CDC posted a blog 3 weeks ago from today, just 3 weeks ago. The CDC put out a blog warning that the CDC's own scientists got the science wrong when it came to masking. I could go on and on and on, but other people want to testify as well. So I would say that the current body of scientific data does not support masking for protection against disease. That's one point. There's a scientific argument to be made. But the real issue wasn't just that, just the scientific issue. It was the serious harm they did to Idahoans both immediately and over time, which affected our health, our minds, our development, and our community as a whole. And with whispers of a new pandemic stirring, every time you look at the news, there's a new mystery disease in China. There's disease X. They're talking about having another pandemic. Now's the crucial moment to shield Idahoans from the kind of government overreach and, in my opinion, medical tyranny that marked the COVID crisis. Forced masking is not just unscientific, like I said, but I believe it to be a direct assault. Our fundamental rights to bodily integrity and autonomy that are enshrined in the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. So today I stand firm in the conviction that no government official, politician, or bureaucrat has the authority to strip us of this our inalienable rights. This is not a path we can afford to tread again. Instead, we must ensure that our response to any health crisis respects the dignity, freedom, and well-being of all Idahoans, and it's grounded in genuine science and unwavering respect for individual rights. And I know everyone has an opinion on this, and there's other people who are signed up to testify, so I'll just leave it there and stand for questions.
That was Republican State Senator Brian Lenny of Nampa. Before that, you heard from Republican Jason Gallagher of Weezer introducing House Bill 493 that would ban local and statewide mask mandates, with the exception of healthcare facilities and vocational settings where face masks are, quote, an integral and compulsory safety component of required job duties. Gallagher, the bill's sponsor, was speaking to the House State Affairs Committee Wednesday. Senator Lenny claimed more recent research has found mask mandates are ineffective and cited a 2023 study in the medical journal BMJ called Child Mask Mandates for COVID-19, a systematic review. The review found studies were not done in a way to reliably demonstrate the effectiveness of mask mandates for children. However, it did not say mask mandates don't work. The Idaho Press reports another BMJ review from 2023 casts doubt on Lenny's assertions. The article called COVID-19 Lockdowns and Masks Helped Reduce Transmission, Expert Group Finds, concluded, quote, non-pharmaceutical interventions were unequivocally effective when rolled out in tandem during the COVID pandemic and led to powerful, effective, and prolonged reductions in viral transmission. The Centers for Disease Control says mask wearing, especially when using a well-fitting N95 mask, is effective for preventing infection and the spread of COVID-19. Democratic Representative John Gannon of Boise questioned Senator Lenny.
Representative Gannon.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and welcome, Senator Lenny. And either for you or your co-sponsor, so what happens if in school a child comes to school, is coughing and hacking, parents aren't home, they've gone off to work, and the child's okay, but does have a cough and whatnot. And so the school nurse says, okay, well, you can go in the classroom, kind of sit over here in a particular place, and please put on a mask, because if you're coughing, I mean, ever since I was a kid, you're not supposed to cough in somebody's face because people think that'll communicate the germs. So this bill would seem to restrict the school nurse or the principal or the teacher from saying, okay, just cover yourself and in that kind of situation.
Senator Lenny.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Gannon, it would. Yeah, that's the point of the bill. Yeah, it would.
Okay. Thank you.
Any further questions, committee? Chairman Crane.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Lenny. To pick up on the line of questioning where Representative Gannon was headed, what did we do, what did parents do, and what did teachers do in a situation before the pandemic in that type of a scenario?
Senator Lenny.
Chair, Madam Chair and Chairman Crane, I don't know. I mean, like, to answer the question, I don't think a hacking, coughing, sick kid should be at school in the first place. I think this bill I'm arguing here in that situation is kind of outside of the scope of this, because I homeschool, so I just tell my kids to go to their room. But, you know.
Thank you, Senator Lenny. Any further questions?
And that was Senator Brian Lenny speaking. There was also some testimony on the bill in the committee, and we'll hear that right now.
My name is Kelly Packer. I am the executive director for the Association of Idaho City, and I stand here in opposition of this bill. I want to first thank all of you for the hard work that you do. I know that you have to struggle through a lot of hard issues on a regular basis. I remember that well. I would ask that you take into consideration that local officials have to do the exact same thing. When we went through the pandemic, none of us had the science that we currently have in front of us. We were simply trying to do the best we could with what we had. It went from 1 week to 1 month to 1 year and longer. And none of us knew throughout that time frame that it would last that long. We simply tried to manage the best we could with what we had. We also didn't know the scientific data at that time. we had a pandemic on our hand, an emergency. And I would ask you not to tie locals' hands in dealing with emergencies that may come in the future. None of us know what they will look like. None of us know what they will entail or what we may need to do to try to keep people safe. We had locals finding themselves in a situation where they had to meet open meeting laws that were passed in this state as well as try to keep people safe. And if you go to most of the city halls in this beautiful state that we live in, there's only maybe 12 to 15 feet total. So you get more than two people in there. They could not meet the requirements of the 6 feet setback. And masks were important because none of us knew what we were dealing with. I think also the important point to make here is that locals went through that too. And maybe they didn't make always the best decisions at the time, but they learned from them. They probably will not be quite as reactive this next time and they will do even better. But again, they need to be able to act in whatever circumstance they may find themselves in, just like you do. And so I would ask you to oppose this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Packer, are there any questions? Representative Skog.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ms. Packer, good to see you. I'm familiar with AIC, and you do some great work. Was your board unanimous to oppose this?
Representative Packer. Ms. Packer, my apologies.
No worries, Madam Chair and Representative Skog. The board was yes. Now, whether there's some cities that are not on the board that feel differently, that could be the case. But our board itself, which represents small and large across the whole state, we have seven districts from top to bottom, so that we can get representatives from each area, as well as a large and a small from each, and past presidents on the board. All of them were unanimous in opposition to this. Thank you.
Any further questions, committee? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Packard. Nice to see you again.
Ditto.
My question is, do the Idaho Association of Cities, do they see that it's a city's responsibility for the safety of their citizens or the safety and health of their citizens?
Ms. Packer. Madam Chair, Representative Scott, both. And they do the best with the information they have at the time, which is exactly what they did during the pandemic. I know there's a lot of high emotions around this. There are on both sides. And I'm not saying that the state didn't go too far with business closures, with masks, with everything, including at the local level. But we had limited information. We didn't know how long the pandemic would last. All of those things. It's really easy to look backwards and say what we would have done differently. And I'm just asking that in emergency services, locals have the ability to make the decisions they need to make for the safe health and safety of their communities.
Representative Scott, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Packard. I'm curious if the cities or the Idaho Association of Cities on behalf of the cities do anything else to address health and safety of their citizens when it comes to maybe issues that are more pressing like heart attack or diabetes. Do they get involved with like stopping sugary drinks and stuff like that? Because those are health and safety issues too. And I'm just wondering what the Idaho Association of Cities promotes for other health and safety issues rather than a cold.
Ms. Packer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott. First, the association didn't promote mask mandates. It was a decision made at the local levels. We are just simply promoting, protecting the ability for locals to make those decisions as they need. You have a variety of cities and sizes throughout the state, and they do manage various things. Some will do after school programs, for example. Some will do mental health programs. Some will, to the extent possible, deal in maybe work with Alzheimer's or the Heart Association or so forth. Not all cities can do that because most of your smaller cities, which is the largest portion of the cities in Idaho, don't have funds to deal with much more than just streets, water and sewer, parks, and those emergency services basics. Larger cities have additional funds that they can do some additional things, and the association does try to help with additional programming where they can, again, with limited funds. The pandemic was a different situation in that we were reacting to the need to provide open meetings with also an unknown health risk with people coming into those close quarters. So It was a matter of trying to manage a circumstance specific to a city responsibility.
All right. Representative Crane.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Kelly, for being here. What did, like, the city of Boise, for example, use as enforcement for not complying with the mask mandate?
Ms. Packer.
Madam Chair and Representative Crane, I can't answer that question. I don't know. I didn't keep track of what all the cities were doing because at that time I wasn't with the association, for one. In fact, I came to the association on April 27th of 2020 after the pandemic had started. And it's not something that I tracked. So I couldn't answer that question.
Follow up?
Yeah. Representative Chair. If I remember right, I think they were going as far as a misdemeanor, which for noncompliance, they were even going to jail time. I remember during that time driving into Boise and being worried that even being in my truck, I might get pulled over and, you know, discuss with an officer or somebody about not wearing one. Do you think that it's important that cities have that kind of authority to throw people in jail if they don't comply with the mask mandate, if Senator Linney is correct and there's another pandemic in the near future? Do you think that's something that they should have the ability to do?
Ms. Packer.
Madam Chair and Representative Crane, to be honest, I do remember that Boise had something on the books about going to jail and so forth, but I don't think it was ever enforced, to be honest. I don't think anybody did go to jail. I don't know that, and so I hate to speak to something that I don't know. That being said, you're talking about one out of 200 cities that maybe took something farther than what you would have wanted them to or that others may have wanted them to. I really would caution this body in making a mandate for all cities who are trying to do their very best because of one. And again, I can't answer to the fact of what actually happened in Boise, and I'm sorry.
That's okay. No further questions. Thanks.
Chairman Crane.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Packer. I think that's one of the concerns that we're dealing with post-pandemic. My city did a decent job managing the crisis. I don't believe there was mask mandates that were required, but there were in Boise, for example. So one of the policy positions that we look at is predictability for citizens as they move across the state. So in the Treasure Valley alone, you have multiple jurisdictions, each city that's handling this differently. Mm-hmm. So if one is putting a penalty, maybe it's a fine, maybe another one's jail time, maybe another one is, you know, whatever. A citizen, as they drive from city to city, don't know what the penalty is going to be for a violation or if there is a penalty. So don't you think that there's some validity to our position that there should be, with respect to masks, a policy statewide that creates certainty and predictability for the citizens of Idaho, no matter what jurisdiction they're in? They're in the sovereign state of Idaho, and this is unacceptable no matter what.
Ms. Packer.
Madam Chair and Chairman Crane, I hear what you're saying, but you also have very unique circumstances in each of those areas. Boise is the largest population base in the state. They had more people that they were trying to manage through a pandemic with than many of our cities. So, I mean, that can go both ways, right? And I'm getting texts from people. It looks like, and I just got from the city of Boise, that the Boise Police Department tried to focus more on education than anything else, and that the city never sent anyone to jail for the mask situation. So I did get that information from the city of Boise, who's probably watching. And I think that that's truly at the heart of this. Most of your local electeds aren't out to harm their residents by throwing them in jail for a mask mandate or for trying to in violation of something that none of us knew how to handle. They're simply trying their best to manage a very chaotic and uncertain circumstance, an emergency. And that's why we're asking that you allow them the tools to do that. Again, I think that you're going to find that the cities have already learned exactly what you're learning as well. And that is that maybe we did go too far in certain circumstances, and we could just make it mandatory in our city halls, right, when people are going to be in close proximity with each other or whatnot. But what I'm asking is allow them to manage the unknowns in the future that they may face when they're the ones responsible for that population in their jurisdiction.
Follow-up.
Certainly. Chairman Crane.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Packer, I understand your position of allowing the cities to manage that. However, the concern that I have sitting on this side of it is that I'm sure they learned from it. But if they have the power to do it again, they can. And I don't know who the mayor will be of X city. And that mayor may see things differently because they weren't in office at that point. And so I think that what we're trying to do is say, hey, here's a baseline. You're not going to tell citizens that they have to mask up and have situations like Mr. Pettinger referenced where people couldn't even get to court or they were going to get thrown in jail because they felt like that their rights were being abused or violated. So do you think that from our perspective, do you understand that having a uniform baseline, this is not acceptable, is a decent position for us to be in?
Ms. Packer.
Madam Chair and Chairman Crane, yes and no. I think that your baseline needs to be something different than just completely getting rid of masks as an option. You know, if you want to set a baseline, maybe it's that you can't throw people in jail for certain things, right? Or that you can't make certain things a misdemeanor. But to say that we can't respond with a mask when we have no idea what other diseases may be coming down the pike, I think is also going a step too far.
Thank you. Ms. Packer, are there any questions? Representative Skog.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Ms. Packer, good to see you. I'm familiar with AIC and you do some great work. Was your board unanimous to oppose this?
Representative Packer. Ms. Packer, my apologies.
No worries, Madam Chair and Representative Skog. The board was yes. Now, whether there's some cities that are not on the board that feel differently, that could be the case. But our board itself, which represents small and large across the whole state, we have 7 districts from top to bottom, so that we can get representatives from each area, as well as a large and a small from each, and past presidents on the board. All of them were unanimous in opposition to this. Thank you.
Any further questions, committee? Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Packard. Nice to see you again.
Ditto.
My question is, do the Idaho Association of Cities, do they see that it's a city's responsibility for the safety of their citizens or the safety and health of their citizens?
Ms. Packer.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, both. And they do the best with the information they have at the time, which is exactly what they did during the pandemic. I know there's a lot of high emotions around this. There are on both sides. And I'm not saying that the state didn't go too far with business closures, with masks, with everything, including at the local level. But we had limited information. We didn't know how long the pandemic would last. All of those things. It's really easy to look backwards and say what we would have done differently. And I'm just asking that in emergency services, locals have the ability to make the decisions they need to make for the safe health and safety of their communities.
Representative Scott, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Packard. I'm curious if the cities or the Idaho Association of Cities on behalf of the cities do anything else to address health and safety of their citizens when it comes to maybe issues that are more pressing like heart attack or diabetes. Do they get involved with like stopping sugary drinks and stuff like that? Because those are health and safety issues too. And I'm just wondering what the Idaho Association of Cities promotes for other health and safety issues rather than a cold.
Ms. Packer.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott. First, the association didn't promote mask mandates. It was a decision made at the local levels. We are just simply promoting, protecting the ability for locals to make those decisions as they need. You have a variety of cities and sizes throughout the state, and they do manage various things. Some will do after school programs, for example. Some will do mental health programs. Some will, to the extent possible, deal in maybe work with Alzheimer's or the Heart Association or so forth. Not all cities can do that because most of your smaller cities, which is the largest portion of the cities in Idaho, don't have funds to deal with much more than just streets, water and sewer, parks, and those emergency services basics. Larger cities have additional funds that they can do some additional things, and the association does try to help with additional programming where they can, again, with limited funds. The pandemic was a different situation in that we were reacting to the need to provide open meetings with also an unknown health risk with people coming into those close quarters. So it was a matter of trying to manage a circumstance specific to a city responsibility.
All right. Representative Crane.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Kelly, for being here. What did, like, the city of Boise, for example, use as enforcement for not complying with the mask mandate?
Ms. Packer.
Madam Chair and Representative Crane, I can't answer that question. I don't know. I didn't keep track of what all the cities were doing because at that time I wasn't with the association, for one. In fact, I came to the association on April 27th of 2020 after the pandemic had started. And it's not something that I tracked. So I couldn't answer that question.
Follow up?
Representative Chair. If I remember right, I think they were going as far as a misdemeanor, which for noncompliance, they were even going to jail time. I remember during that time driving into Boise and being worried that even being in my truck, I might get pulled over and, you know, discuss with an officer or somebody about not wearing one. Do you think that it's important that cities have that kind of authority to throw people in jail if they don't comply with the mask mandate, if Senator Linney is correct and there's another pandemic in the near future? Do you think that's something that they should have the ability to do?
Ms. Packer.
Madam Chair and Representative Crane, to be honest, I do remember that Boise had something on the books about going to jail and so forth, but I don't think it was ever enforced, to be honest. I don't think anybody did go to jail. I don't know that, and so I hate to speak to something that I don't know. That being said, you're talking about one out of 200 cities that maybe took something farther than what you would have wanted them to or that others may have wanted them to. I really would caution this body in making a mandate for all cities who are trying to do their very best because of one. And again, I can't answer to the fact of what actually happened in Boise, and I'm sorry.
That's okay. No further questions. Thanks.
Chairman Crane.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Packer. I think that's one of the concerns that we're dealing with post-pandemic. My city did a decent job managing the crisis. I don't believe there was mask mandates that were required, but there were in Boise, for example. So one of the policy positions that we look at is predictability for citizens as they move across the state. So in the Treasure Valley alone, you have multiple jurisdictions, each city that's handling this differently. Mm-hmm. So if one is putting a penalty, maybe it's a fine, maybe another one's jail time, maybe another one is, you know, whatever. A citizen, as they drive from city to city, don't know what the penalty is going to be for a violation or if there is a penalty. So don't you think that there's some validity to our position that there should be, with respect to masks, a policy statewide that creates certainty and predictability for the citizens of Idaho, no matter what jurisdiction they're in? They're in the sovereign state of Idaho, and this is unacceptable no matter what.
Ms. Packer.
Madam Chair and Chairman Crane, I hear what you're saying, but you also have very unique circumstances in each of those areas. Boise is the largest population base in the state. They had more people that they were trying to manage through a pandemic with than many of our cities. So, I mean, that can go both ways, right? And I'm getting texts from people. It looks like, and I just got from the city of Boise, the Boise Police Department tried to focus more on education than anything else, and that the city never sent anyone to jail for the mask situation. So I did get that information from the city of Boise, who's probably watching. And I think that that's truly at the heart of this. Most of your local electeds aren't out to harm their residents by throwing them in jail for a mask mandate or for trying to in violation of something that none of us knew how to handle. They're simply trying their best to manage a very chaotic and uncertain circumstance, an emergency. And that's why we're asking that you allow them the tools to do that. Again, I think that you're going to find that the cities are already have already learned exactly what you're learning as well. And that is that maybe we did go to.
And that was Idaho Association of Cities Executive Director Kelly Packer testifying against a bill in the Idaho State, the Idaho House State Affairs Committee on Wednesday that would ban local governments and health districts from imposing mask ordinances across the state of Idaho. We'll have more testimony on this bill, which the House State Affairs Committee passed on to the full House on Wednesday after this message.
Love's Kombucha is proud to support KRFP Radio Free Moscow. Love's Kombucha is a fun, lively, fermented probiotic tea that is craft brewed right here in Moscow. For more information, visit loveskombucha.com.
My name is Leslie Manukian. I represent Health Freedom Defense Fund, a nationally known nonprofit that seeks to protect our health rights. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Super. Thank you so much. First of all, I just wanted to say that schools didn't do anything in the past except for have the children go home if they were sick. They didn't mask children. I don't know why we would be thinking that was appropriate today. Secondly, I'd like to say that Haley, the city of Haley, actually threatened the police chief, put out a post on Facebook that he would arrest people who did not comply. So it wasn't just Boise. In addition, I think it's really important that we understand that we have known the science for more than a century. In fact, since 1918, we have known that masks do not stop transmission or infection. This was actually written up in an article in Washington Post, but we knew this because there were cities in San Francisco and in California, San Francisco and others that did have mask mandates and others that didn't in 1918, and there was no difference in outcomes. Washington Post headline was, "We used masks before, they didn't work, what now?" So it's not the case that we didn't know. Secondly, May 2020, CDC published an article or published a paper, their own science showing that masks do not stop transmission of respiratory infections. And yet they led the country down the garden path saying that masks would work. They knew from their own research in May of 2020. If you force masks or if you allow cities to have the opportunity to mask us, you are essentially forcing people to do something not only against their conscience, but something that they know. It's like compelled dress. You're asking them to do something that they know is not appropriate. And I don't think this is something that belongs in a free country. Life carries risk, and each of us has to make our own assessments of how we live our lives.
Leslie, your time is up.
Okay, we can't force medical interventions on people.
Super. Thank you, Leslie. Representative Scott has a question for you.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Leslie, you said you're with the Health Freedom Defense Fund, and I'm guessing that's some kind of a law firm. Have you had any cases about masks in your fund, with your defense fund?
Ms. Manukian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, Representative Scott. Health Freedom Defense Fund has sued the Biden administration three times. We are the organization that stopped the federal travel mask mandate. And the reason that we stopped the federal travel mask mandate was because CDC lacked the statutory authority to mandate masks, but also because there is no science. CDC failed to submit a single randomized controlled trial to the Federal Register in defense of its or in support of its mandate. Not a single one, because they don't have one. So we have, successfully took that down. There is an abundance of science showing that that masks do not actually work as purported in the community setting, and forcing people to wear these just doesn't make any sense.
Follow up,
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and. Leslie, so is that's yes to the lawsuit? Because I've heard that this Freedom Defense Fund has done something with lawsuits. So I caught maybe one that was successful. Was it successful?
Ms. Manukian.
Oh, yes.
Go ahead.
Sorry, Madam Chair. Let me say that we defeated the federal travel mask mandate. We, however, failed to defeat a mask mandate in Haley, Idaho. And the judge did not review any of the evidence from our scientists. The judge just deferred to what the CDC said, even though we could prove that the CDC was not being forthright with respect to the science. And the reason is because Idaho code does not protect us on this front. Idaho code needs to be updated in order to ensure that a government cannot overreach and dictate these kinds of policies, whether they are science-based or not. What guarantee do we have going forward that that we're not going to see this overreach again, that they're not going to ignore the science that does not support their conclusion? What guarantee do we have of this? We don't have any.
Right. Thank you, Ms. Manoukian. Seeing no further questions, thank you for your testimony today. Next up, we have Garth Gaylord.
Hi, I'm Garth Gaylord. Just me. And I just want to thank Legislator Gallagher for bringing this mask bill to the legislature. It's finally about time that we get a mask mandate bill going, because the COVID is still in the air. It can get in your hair. It can get in your ears. It can get in your eyes. And so I'd ask Gallagher to actually put a goggle mandate as well, and maybe a helmet. Because you don't want to get in your hair, then you touch your hair while you're shampooing and it gets in your mouth. So, and they like gloves too. People should have to wear gloves all the time. I'm just, all those legislators, it was alarming that so many legislators just kept meeting during the COVID without masks on, just causing so much danger. I think there should be an investigation into like all the contact tracing information to see how many people were killed by the certain people that didn't wear masks, or that, you know, recklessly just allowed people to breathe air and show their face. No, I'm just kidding. But I'm in favor of this bill, and I was arrested for not wearing a mask many times. They twisted my wrist, slammed my head. I spent 3 weeks in jail for not wearing a mask, and they had a mask mandate in the jail, so they kept me confined to a cell for 3 weeks straight, all because I wouldn't wear a mask. And they constantly harassed me, trying to get me to wear a mask. I know many others in Boise that got arrested too. Robert Downs, Eva Selick.
It looks like your time is up.
I'm Misty Carlfeld. I'm with Health Freedom Idaho, and I ask that you do pass this bill. And I'm going to talk about this actually from a religious perspective, and I'd like to remind the committee that there were pastors arrested in Moscow for worshiping outside without a mask on. To wear a mask on my face goes against God and my religious beliefs, and therefore the Constitution. As a Christian, I view the mask as an affront to what I know to be true in the Word of God. Genesis 1:27, Genesis 9:26, and Colossians 3:10 says that I am made in the image and likeness of God. As Job 33:4 states perfectly, quote, "The Spirit of God has made me. The breath of the Almighty gives me life. I will not hide the image of God, nor hinder the breath of life, which is my very connection to my Creator." 1 Corinthians 2:5 says that your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God. I have faith that I am made in perfectly by my Creator, with a perfectly designed immune system, as God saw his creation was good. In Genesis 1:3, Romans 1:17 says the righteous live by faith, and Mark 10:52 says that we can experience healing through faith. Therefore, my faith is in the one true Creator God, and not the shifting direction of Dr. Fauci and the CDC. My religious liberty is my birthright and is supported by the Constitution. Therefore, this is actually also a religious freedom bill. What you'll also find on Health Freedom Idaho's website is all of the talking points that we've talked about today. They're not effective. It's actually hazardous to children. There's psychological and social impacts to people, and also the ethical consideration. And one last final thing. I'd like to leave with the committee. In our quest to safeguard public health, we must not sacrifice the very principles upon which our society is built: freedom, autonomy, unyielding belief in the inherent dignity of every individual, and religious freedom. Thank you so much.
That was some of the testimony in favor of House Bill 493, which was sponsored by Republican Representative Jason Gallagher. The bill would ban local and statewide mask mandates with the exceptions of healthcare facilities and vocational settings where face masks are, quote, an integral and compulsory safety component of required job duties. Misty Carlfeld of the Health Freedom Idaho group claimed two pastors were arrested in Moscow for preaching without a mask. However, the people Moscow police arrested in October 2020 for not physical distancing and violating the mask ordinance during a Psalm Sing protest at City Hall were not pastors. Whether the claim made by Leslie Manukian of the Health Freedom Defense Fund that her organization stopped the Biden administration's travel mask mandate is open to interpretation. The U.S. Justice Department released a statement on April 19, 2022, regarding the Health Freedom Defense Fund case, saying, quote, the Department of Justice and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention disagree with the district court's decision and will appeal, subject to CDC's conclusion that the order remains necessary for public health. The department continues to believe that the order requiring masking in transportation corridors is a valid exercise of the authority Congress has given the CDC to protect the public health. That is an important authority the department will continue to work to preserve. On April 13, 2022, before the district court's decision, CDC explained that the order would remain in effect while it assessed current public health conditions and that the Transportation Security Administration would extend its directive implementing the order until May 3rd to facilitate CDC's assessment. If CDC concludes that a mandatory order remains necessary for the public's health after that assessment, the Department of Justice will appeal the district court's decision, unquote. By April 2022, the number of infections and deaths from COVID-19 was waning, in part because of vaccination uptake, and the Transportation Security Administration, which already was planning to make a decision on ending the travel mask mandate by May 3, 2022, determined the mandate was no longer needed at that point in the pandemic. Much of the testimony claimed that mask mandates that save lives are overreach. The Centers for Disease Control says mask wearing, especially when using a well-fitting N95 mask, is effective for preventing infection and the spread of COVID-19. The Idaho Press reports another BMJ review from 2023 casts doubt on Senator Brian Lenny's assertions. The article called COVID-19 Lockdowns and Masks Helped Reduce Transmission, Expert Groups Finds, concluded, quote, non-pharmaceutical interventions were unequivocally effective when rolled out in tandem during the COVID pandemic and led to powerful, effective, and prolonged reductions in viral transmission. The COVID-19 pandemic killed 1.77 million people in the U.S., The U.S. has the highest rate of COVID deaths per capita on the planet. Idaho, which had few mask mandates, lower vaccine uptake than other states, shorter lockdown periods, and more widespread resistance to pandemic abatement strategies than most states, had 112 COVID deaths per 100,000 citizens, 17th highest in the nation. Washington, which had a statewide mask mandate for much of the worst of the pandemic period, had 61.5 COVID deaths per 100,000 citizens, making it the sixth safest state in the country during the pandemic. After less than an hour of testimony on House Bill 493 Wednesday, the House State Affairs Committee sent the bill to the House floor. You're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report here on KRFP Moscow Pullman. We'll be back in a moment.
KRFP is supported by listeners like you and by
Moscow Ale House, with something for everyone in the family. You can find Moscow Ale House at 226 West 6th Street or call 208-882-BREW. That's 208-882-2739.
Foreign detainees at Guantanamo Bay, who are still there.
America, the beautiful, aspirational, welcoming place.
Do not have the right to make due process claims in court.
For America, the fearful, bitter, resentful, petty, not enough for all you foreigners place.
Peace Radio is back.
This is equally bummer.
Dear Mr. President.
Every other Sunday, 2 to 4 p.m. here on KRFP 90.3 FM and online.
Pardoned by Trump.
You'll find that Native Americans are familiar with the idea that a pandemic is a great time for capitalists to make some profit.
Every other Sunday.
Much of Bezos' new wealth is a result of changing consumer habits during the pandemic.
This is a message to my people, man. I know we only fighting to feel equal. Damn, use your words.
You have to stop. My eyes can't roll back any further.
People with no deceitful plan. Nah, stand together, we'll be better in the end. I'm only reaching out. I got a hand that I can lend. I hope.
Bad karaoke night.
Jolene. Ow! Stop throwing those tomatoes.
Come to bad karaoke night at Mikey's.
Pay to sing a song. Pay double to stop a song.
Please don't take them even though you can. Ow! Oh, rotten cantaloupe. What are you doing to the piano?
Saturday, February 17th, Mikey's Heroes, 7 p.m.
527 South Main Street, downtown Moscow.
And we now turn to our second featured segment on the extended edition of the KRFP Evening Report for Friday, February 16th. On Monday, the Idaho Senate State Affairs Committee passed a new bill aimed at preventing minors from having access to library materials deemed harmful. Republican Representative Jerome Crane of Nampa pulled his earlier bill from the House floor and worked with Republican Senator Jeff Schroeder of Mountain Home on a new bill that includes elements of his bill, including that parents or minors can pursue a lawsuit against a library district or school district for $250 damages if they or their offspring receive material deemed harmful. That's much less than the $2,500 damages that could have been awarded under last year's bill, which Governor Brad Little vetoed. The new bill defines material as harmful to minors if they include nudity, sexual conduct, sexual excitement, or sadomasochistic abuse when it appeals to the prurient interest of minors as judged by the average person applying contemporary community standards and when depictions are patently offensive to prevailing standards in the adult community with respect to what is suitable material for minors. Bill supporters claim there is pornographic material in schools and public libraries accessible to minors, something librarians around the state deny. Here is Senator Jeff Schroeder introducing Senate Bill 1289 in the Senate State Affairs Committee on Monday morning.
We continue to hear reports that there is pornographic material available to minors in our libraries. So in order to figure out the degree to which that's happening or if it's happening in a particular case, what we have going on now is people claiming that it happens. We have library directors correctly saying, no, it's not, or this doesn't meet the standards. But you have people carrying the narrative that they have somehow found this. Well, we have a statutory definition in Idaho Code 18.15.14.6a for material that is harmful to minors. And so the first part of what this bill seeks to do is to get everybody grounded and pointed in the same direction as to what a definition of material harmful to minors is. So all parts of the process throughout this make reference to the same definition of material harmful to minors in Idaho, and it incorporates the Miller test, and it constitutionally adds a reference to minors. The second thing the bill does is establishes A material review committee, no less than three persons, at least one, the parent of a minor child in the district, and it may be the governing board, or it could include members of the governing board. That's up to the decision of the library. So library boards, school boards have a great deal of business they must attend to. If they don't want to have to deal with these sorts of things, they can appoint a review committee to do so. They can encourage members of the community to be part of that review committee. The third thing is this requires that there be a form, a compliant form that refers to the statutory definition of material harmful to minors, and the person requesting that this material be moved or placed in an adult section has to be framed in terms of that statute. So in other words, you show up and say, I want to do something about this book. You're going to be reviewing the Idaho Code section, and you're going to see the degree to which a particular piece that you're objecting to does or does not meet that definition. The fourth part is it requires an orderly process, a hearing process, to determine whether the material in question does meet that definition. So the person objecting gets to present to the review committee about why the material does meet this definition. Other persons who are interested are able to participate in the hearing, and they have a right to testify. Currently, what you have is a complaint, a dissatisfied patron, and then they have to show back up at open mic night with pitchforks and torches, and everybody's yelling and nobody gets anywhere. So what this does is it says we're going to have a hearing like a zoning hearing. The applicant makes a presentation, there's a rebuttal, and there's a closure, and then the committee. The next part is it requires a reasoned written decision of the committee as to whether or not the material in question meets the statutory definition and whether or not the material should be moved. So that's the main part of this, which is to get libraries and their patrons involved in learning about the degree to which materials can be ordered by the government to be segregated to an adult section, passing constitutional muster using the Miller test. If, for some reason, a patron thinks that that review committee has cooked the books on their decision and just skewed it and just summarily said, we're going to segregate the book, or no, we're not, it allows for judicial review of that decision. And a judge can take a look over the shoulder and say, did they arrive at this decision using reason? Did they use the standards contained in the statute? Did they use the standards contained in the Constitution to arrive at the decision? But that judicial review process isn't available unless and until the person first says, hey, you guys got this wrong, I want you to reconsider. So you have to ask the board to reconsider. If you think they got it wrong, if they fail to do that or don't do it, then you can seek judicial review. If a review committee orders material to be moved and the library still somehow fails to move the book, and the patron says, hey, library, you failed to move the book, I'm giving you notice that you need to move the book as the review board ordered, then and only then can a person seek a private right of action to have that enforced. The other fallback here is in the last section that allows a county prosecutor to seek injunctive relief to require a district or a city to follow the requirements of the act. So if a district or a city is not following requirements, a prosecutor can seek injunctive relief.
And that was Republican Senator Jeff Schroeder introducing Senate Bill 1289 in the Senate State Affairs Committee on Monday. Co-sponsor Representative Jerome Crean of Nampa said the new bill addresses some of Governor Brad Little's concerns that led to his veto of last year's library bill. Governor Little had said last year's bill had amounted to a bounty system for libraries and could bankrupt school districts or libraries. Here's Jerome Crean.
There were two issues from House Bill 314 last year that we passed off the House and Senate floor that the governor had issue with. He wanted us to go and address that there wouldn't be any frivolous lawsuits, and he also did not want any library in Idaho to go bankrupt over this legislation. So I think what we have come up with here, Senator Schroeder and myself, is a very good bill to address both of those things. On page 2, starting at line 5, you're going to see the written relocation form. That form will reference directly Idaho Code 18-15-14-6A. So if you find a piece of material in the library and you think that it needs to be relocated to an adult section, You'll have to fill out that form and reference on that form the things that that book violates. You'll turn that in, and then they go to the review committee and go through the process that Senator Schroeder's outlined there. So that right there is going to eliminate a lot of those frivolous lawsuits, so to speak. We also lowered the damages from last year's bill, House Bill 314, from $2,500 to $250. With the process and the lowering of the damages, we believe we have addressed the governor's concerns with House Bill 314.
Much of the testimony in the 2.5-hour hearing was against House Bill 1289, although a few testified they were against it because it does not go far enough to punish librarians. We'll start with Jenny Emery Davidson, who is an Idaho librarian, speaking against the bill, followed by other testimony.
My name is Jenny Emery Davidson. I am a constituent of District 26. I grew up in Idaho, and I have worked in an Idaho library for the past 10 years. I oppose Senate Bill 1289. I could dissect the many real implementation challenges this bill would pose for libraries, particularly small rural libraries and school libraries. For example, if a little library like the one in Bellevue, which is run by one wondrous part-time employee, has to implement this process, it will be at the expense of other things, like summer reading or helping senior citizens access telehealth appointments. But I think maybe it is most important to dissect what problem this bill is trying to solve. What we have seen over the past 3 years, from House Bill 666 through to this bill here today, is not people being dissatisfied with library processes. In fact, as was just illustrated, there have been breathtakingly few instances of people even engaging in existing processes to ask for a book to be reconsidered. Rather, what we have seen, again, as just illustrated, are the attempts of a few people to label certain books as pornographic, not according to the Miller test or to state statute, but because they include homosexual characters or people of color. What we have seen are attempts to censor groups of people. That is antithetical to the First Amendment. It is damaging to individuals, and it is destructive to communities. In Idaho libraries right now, people enjoy the freedom to choose what they read. Parents have the freedom to talk to librarians to make informed choices about what their children read. They have the freedom to read with their children. People have the freedom to go to a library or not, and they choose to go by the hundreds of thousands because they trust and depend on their local libraries as they are.
You can wrap up. It's not well, a drop dead time, but it's just an indication to wrap up.
So. Okay, thank you. You do. You all have the power to maintain this freedom that people are enjoying right now. Please reject Bill 1289 and stop advancing legislation that legitimizes efforts at censorship. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Senator Wintrow.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Ms. Davidson. Real quick question. So for your library, could you tell me what kind of requests that you've received for reconsideration and how that's gone?
Ms. Davidson.
Senator Guthrie and Senator Wintrow. I have been in my position at my library for 10 years. In that time period, we have circulated well over 1 million books. The number of formal requests for reconsideration that we have received is zero. We have had conversations with people who, because people, we do actually have a problem that does exist, as there is an epidemic of loneliness in this country. And we do have people who come up to the circulation desk and want to talk about what they read. And as Mr. Wright just suggested, there will be conversations about where is this book housed, and it is resolved at the level of conversation. And the number of people who have engaged in a formal request for reconsideration process is zero.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony. Lindsay Clark Youngworth.
Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Bettweiser, and I am a contract lobbyist with the firm Signet.
Can you get close to the... There you go.
I'm here today representing the Idaho Library Association, testifying on Senate Bill 1289. The Idaho Library Association is a professional organization comprised of Idaho libraries. When I took the libraries on as a client a few years ago, I truly could not have imagined how much space they'd occupy in this building. It has been a challenging few years for folks on every side of this issue. I am proud to serve as an advocate for libraries. Libraries serve all. They are frontline for some of our most vulnerable populations. They are there to assist with literacy. They are frontline for our unhoused. They are frontline for rural folks who need to access telehealth. And they are frontline for those who want a safe place to imagine. Libraries are a community asset. While the ILA does not believe that legislation is necessary, as the overwhelming majority of our libraries have community-led collection development policies in place, driven by community-elected or appointed boards, we recognize the legislature's desire to put something in place to address the perceived issues. The ILA does not oppose Senate Bill 1289, and we are incredibly appreciative to have been included as stakeholders in the crafting of this legislation. While we still have concerns about some of the components of this bill, we are grateful that it mirrors and standardizes the processes that most of our libraries already have in place. And after years of trying to address this issue, we think that this is probably about as good as it's going to get for all involved. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm happy to try and address any questions.
Are there questions, Senator Lee?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Ms. Bettweiser. Thanks for that testimony. Is there anything in this piece of proposed legislation that prohibits the conversation that can be had? So if someone comes to the desk and says, hey, I'm concerned about this, must they fill out this form or can they still have a conversation about, hey, someone left this book in the children's section? I wanted to bring this to your attention.
Ms. Bettweiser.
Chairman, Senator Lee, from my perspective, I don't believe that this would prevent anyone from having that conversation.
Don't see any other questions, and I want to thank you. I know you've been at least a couple years or more helping out on this issue and a tough issue, but appreciate your involvement in those discussions.
Thank you, Chairman.
Thank you. Next, we're going to go virtual to Heather Stout, or at least hopefully we'll be successful.
Hey, I'm good here. Morning. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, can you hear us?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Yeah, welcome to committee. Introduce yourself, and the next 2 minutes is yours.
Thank you so much. Thank you, Chairman and committee members. My name is Heather Stout. I am a retired professional librarian. My expertise is youth services. I live just north of Genesee, Idaho, and I'm representing myself. This legislation is totally unnecessary, and I urge you not to move S-1289 forward. Libraries provide library services and materials to all, regardless of who they are. Some parents may feel uncomfortable with certain subjects they find in the library. And you know what? That's okay. We are all different, and we all have different needs at different times of our lives. Parents have every right to parent their own children and to decide what books and materials they can access. They do not have the right to parent other people's children, and I would hope the state of Idaho would realize they don't either. Libraries in Idaho already have written policies and procedures, including an avenue for patrons to request reconsideration of materials. Under this bill, if there is a decision made to relocate materials, I'd ask, how will that exactly work? The language in this bill states that libraries will not make available obscene materials to minors. That language is extremely vague. It might lead to important books being relocated and removed just because they represent people different than the people making the request. What happens when a minor sees a book on the adult shelf, and I'll say in Beauville, and pulls it off? Did that library make it available? This language is so vague, it really creates real problems for libraries. And I disagree with Senator Schroeder. There is a huge financial impact on small libraries because most of them are staffed by one, maybe two people. Section 8 of this bill allows for any minor parent or legal guardian to recover $250 in statutory damages as well as actual damages. Are we really going to go down that path again, putting bounties on libraries and librarians? Instead, why aren't parents expected to be the ones monitoring what their children read? Please stop demanding that libraries and librarians do so. It's not their job. And in conclusion, Idaho librarians are being targeted. They are scared. And many are leaving the profession, and they're leaving the state. This bill will not help. It will intensify the exodus. Please table 1289 and do not move it forward. Thank you, and I'll stand for questions.
I don't see any questions. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you.
I'm likely going to butcher this, but Mir Yasar Saeed Bagari, and I sincerely apologize. It indicates that that individual is in person. Okay. Let's go to Jeff Kohler.
Good morning, Senators. I'm Jeff Kohler, a trustee of the Meridian Library District. However, this morning I speak only for myself and not on behalf of that board. I have concerns about how 1289 would be implemented in real life. First of all, these material review committees called for in the bill will be best served by thoughtful, methodical individuals who won't be swayed by emotional public opinion. But anyone who's been paying attention to the culture war surrounding libraries the past few years would think twice before sticking their neck out to get involved in a book review committee required to take public testimony for each and every book that garners a complaint. If you heard some of the vitriolic testimony at our past board meetings or saw the multi-night circus at the Ada County Commissioners last year when a group tried to disband our library district, you would understand what I'm talking about. I'd love to believe
myself. Thank you, committee members and Chairman Guthrie. I'm an associate librarian, and I'm here to urge you to vote no on Senate Bill 1289. Senators, this bill is redundant and puts an undue burden on public libraries as a response to non-existent problems. Libraries already have written processes in place to respond to requests for reconsideration. The system is working. The libraries are participating. You are just not happy with the final decision. Additionally, public libraries do not own anything that does not comply with the Miller test. This means that this bill is unnecessary and that the threat to minors is not real. Aside from that, this bill will bog down already very busy people and lead to widespread administrative gridlock across the state. The lengthy hearing process will take away from time to address real community concerns. This is not a community interest. 69% of Idahoans trust library staff with public book selections. That's according to the Idaho Public Policy Survey. Furthermore, we have no way to predict how many times this bill will be abused for illegitimate reasons. This will be coming out of taxpayers' wallets, as public libraries are publicly funded. It is a waste of taxpayer money to fund frivolous lawsuits with no real grounds. Libraries will be paying far more than $250 considering potential legal fees. We cannot fund bookmobile repairs, collection development, building maintenance, and other vital necessities when we are worried about the monetary setbacks imposed by this bill. Finally, this is a slippery slope towards mass censorship, which is inherently harmful to your constituents and defeats the tenets of a public library. Allowing lawful limitations on information access will lead to larger imbalances of power and narrowed world perspectives. An uneducated public is an unsafe public. Senators, do not be afraid of books. Be afraid of the people who want to limit access to them. Do not pass Senate Bill 1289. Thank you.
Thank you for the testimony. Just kind of remind everybody, let's be real careful about impugning the motives of others. And so just as we go forward with testimony, and are there questions for Ms. Burgess?
And you're listening to some of the testimony in the Senate State Affairs Committee on Monday on Senate Bill 1289. We'll continue with the testimony in just a moment.
Programming on KRFP is made possible in part by support from KRFP members and
John's Alley Tavern, Moscow's home of live music. John's Alley is located at 114 East 6th Street in downtown Moscow.
KRFP, Moscow.
Chairman Guthrie and committee members, my name is Bonnie Schuster. I live in Boise. I represent myself, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify today. As a longtime library user and supporter, I have followed all of these library bills, and I truly do appreciate the work that the sponsors did to try to craft a bill that would balance the interests surrounding this issue. It is so much better than prior versions in that it would use established legal precedent to define harmful materials. It respects the important roles of the local school or library boards, and it does not criminalize librarians. Notwithstanding these improvements, I am against the bill. It will result in significant new costs for our libraries. The costs of the legal notices of public hearings, even if they get to use the state rate for the public hearings, the attorney fees that will need to be incurred to defend a request for judicial review, and the potential civil penalties and damages. Such costs will be particularly burdensome for our smaller libraries. These are public libraries. They are for all of us, not just people who look and live and think and pray like you and I. Their collections must include a wide range of materials to serve all of us. This issue does not require legislation. Many of our libraries, especially the larger ones, already have robust processes for patrons to request reconsideration of materials. I've read a whole lot of those policies over the last several weeks. Beyond these policies, the solution is the same as it always was, parental responsibility. Please do not advance this bill and let our libraries focus on serving all of us. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Martha Williams. I'm a member of District 26. Thank you for your time. I've worked at a library for the last 5 years, and I won't reiterate some of the great points that others like my colleague Jenny Emery Davidson or Jeff Kohler and Heather Stout have made, but I do want to urge you to not advance this bill. One thing I do like about the bill, this is the single thing I like, is its emphasis on local communities. Yet it's unclear why individual libraries need the legislature to tell them how to do what they're already doing, as I think has been shared through many of the comments so far. Libraries and librarians are responsive to their communities, and they have a responsibility to be responsive to all members of the community, not just to those who are loudest or object specific materials. Those who are quietest are often those most in need of the library's attention, and this bill will only restrict librarians' ability to serve these people and their entire and pluralistic communities. I ask this committee to consider the voices of all Idahoans as you evaluate this bill. Who is it really helping, and who might it harm? Will you listen to the voices of those who trust their libraries and understand them as places where different opinions and values can coexist? Or will you listen to the voices that imply libraries are dangerous places? Senator Schroeder said that this bill does not ban books, but what it does do is allow individuals to ban books from access from the rest of their communities, and that is censorship. Libraries are not dangerous places. Unless one fears diversity of thought, the multiplicity of experiences and values, and Idahoans' ability to coexist and thrive together. Dialogue, as Senator Schroeder also said, is what we need, not legislation. Librarians in their communities can have dialogue without legislation, and they are, and we are, doing this. This bill is not needed by Idahoans, our communities, or our libraries. This bill and any future similar bill takes you away from the important work of guiding our state. It takes librarians away from their work for their communities, but it empowers the wishes of those who are vocal and not representative of the majority of Idahoans. Please reject this bill and similar future efforts, and please instead devote your energy to bills that people in Idaho do want and do need.
Senator Wintrow, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Williams, would you share with us kind of maybe, sounds like you're having conversations in your community and your libraries. Are these issues coming up, and how are they being resolved by your folks?
Ms. Williams.
Yes, thank you. So we have, at our library, we have had a few conversations with members of the community, similar to what was shared earlier, I believe, by Jeff Kohler. Many of these conversations have been grounded in what I consider to be misinformation. People coming into the library asking about whether we have books in our collection, which we don't have. Sometimes we don't have in our collection, or they certainly aren't in the areas of the library that these individuals are concerned about. And we have had these conversations, no formal challenges. The conversations have led to, I hope, better understanding. I don't know that they've achieved agreement, but they have been informative about where people in the community stand and what fears people have. And I think fear of change and fear of difference underlies so many of these efforts. And that is what I urge you to consider as you are reviewing this bill.
Thank you again for joining us. I don't see any other questions. Thank you.
My name is Paige Beach. I live in District 22, and I have worked in Idaho libraries for 8 years now, but I'm speaking on behalf of myself. As others have stated, the financial aspect of this bill is, I think, the real issue. That takes away from our ability to do lots of things. So it's more than the $250, although I would argue that's quite a sum, especially for rural libraries. And I wanted to throw some kind of realistic numbers at people from my budget so they could kind of see how much $250 or more is going to cost us in terms of serving and providing resources to the community. So last year, and I'm with a big city library, so these are larger numbers than the rural libraries, we had $4 per child for our summer reading program. Our summer reading program, we want to give kids books so they can have at least we know one free book at home to read over the summer to prevent learning loss. We want to give them educational programs during the summers, keep them excited about reading. We want to give them incentives however we can. And we have $4 per child to do that, which, as you can see, that's probably not even going to buy us a book, right? So those are the numbers we're working with. We also have, I do a 6-week preparation class to get ready for kindergarten. A lot of our community members cannot afford to send their kids to preschool, and I do that for $0. So these fines, these fees, this time, this extra time and effort is really affecting the ability that we have to give resources and services to our community. And I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
And I would expect that those kids enjoy seeing your smile. So
I hope so.
Yeah. I don't see any questions. Thank you for being in committee this morning.
My name is Dora Jo Messerly. I'm from Soda Springs, Idaho, District 35. And I speak to you today in opposition of this bill because it is simply unnecessary. I'm a public librarian of 15 years. My more specific title is children's librarian. I run multiple programs a week for children's ages 0 to 18. From Lego Club to book clubs, from story time to music and movement, our programs are well attended and enjoyed by many in our community. Idaho libraries and librarians are not okay. In the midst of waging war against books, the shelves of our library have become the battlefield. Our patrons must not become the casualties. I'd just like to list a few things that I think need to be taken into consideration today. Throughout this process, I've been told multiple times and by a group of 10 to 15 legislators that librarians are not doing enough. This is not true. We are doing much more than we are ever being paid for. I think if you walked into a local library, you will find they already have this form. Every library that I'm aware of has one. When will we separate school libraries and public libraries? These are two very separate institutions. Library collections are largely driven by their patrons in their communities. My local library director has been director for 23 years and has never had a challenge of a book. The challenges that we have faced recently because of bills that have come up are people in our community coming in to actually ask the question if we have these specific books, because they are afraid we are banning books in our community. They want to be sure that every person in our community is being represented. I agree with so much that has been said today. I pray that you will not advance this bill. I will stand for questions, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And I apologize because I went with a silent J when I introduced you, but
it's all good.
Thank you for correcting
Everybody
me.
Does.
Thank you. I don't see any questions. Mary Rucked, and I'll probably mess that one up too. Welcome to committee. Please correct me on the pronunciation. The time's yours.
No, good job. Good morning, Chairman Guthrie and committee members. My name is Mary Ruck. I've lived in Boise just for 8 years, and I am speaking for myself in opposition to S-1289. Different perspective. I'm a grandmother of two elementary school girls whom I love dearly. They are thriving in the Boise public school system, and both are avid readers and patrons of our terrific Boise public library system. Their parents, my son and his wife, they exercise control over the books that the girls read. Predominantly, it's their parents, my granddaughter's parents, it's their responsibility to manage those girls' reading repertoire, not the libraries or the courts or the legislatures. Their parents care for the girls' tender, developing minds, and they respond to questions the girls have about things they might read in books, or on the internet, or see on TV, or hear in public spaces. Over the past several years, I have attended many committee meetings, hearings about this issue, and have yet to hear any truly compelling reasons for legislative intervention. Please don't spend any more resources on this problem. fabricated problem. It is a local control issue. It's a parental control issue, and library collection standards and processes already exist, as everybody keeps saying. Though I believe there is no need for legislative intervention, if you believe you must pass something, then at least remove the civil cause of action and the financial penalties components of this bill. Thank you for listening. Appreciate it. And consider voting no on 1289. Thank you.
Thank you for being in committee. I don't see any questions. Nope. Destiny Hart. Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself. The time's yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is Destiny Hart, and I'm a resident of District 21 in Meridian. I'm also an elected trustee for the Meridian Library District. But I am speaking on behalf of myself and not the district today. As a mom of four children under the age of 12, I appreciate Senator Schroeder's work on this, and I deeply understand the concerns around this issue. But I believe that this legislation has some kinks that need to be worked out and has the potential to be very expensive and cumbersome on library districts. The legal fees that Meridian taxpayers will have to pay in order to have legal counsel help us untangle the conflicting language in this bill alone will probably number in the thousands. I only have time to address a couple of my concerns, but I've also got a document here for each of you that outlines all of them in detail. The first 2.5 pages of the bill reference a materials relocation policy, but beginning on page 3, line 14, the bill begins to use the language make available to minors, along with references to removing segregating materials or restricting access to them. This is incompatible with the first half of the bill and confusing, as I'm unsure what make available means. Are materials available to minors if they're in the adult section of the library? Say a book is relocated from the children's section to the adult section. Is that enough? Or are we also relocating books from the adult section to somewhere else just because they're not suitable for minors? I can't think of any other way to technically restrict access to books other than doing that. In that case, I can't imagine our adult patrons not feeling like that's a violation of their rights to access material in a public library that their tax dollars pay for. The answer may be found on page 4, where we learn about affirmative defense to civil liability. So we essentially have to check ID for every person entering the library and ensure that each child is with a legal guardian in order to limit taxpayer liability, which is part of my job as a library trustee.
If you could wrap up.
Sure. I don't come to you with complaints and no solutions. If you have to pass unnecessary legislation censoring materials in public libraries, please send this bill to be amended and consider the proposed changes that I bring today. Thank you.
Thank you. And you can give those to the page if you'd like, unless we already have them. But
as Mike Wade, I'm representing myself. I live in District 26. I'm a retired school teacher and coach. I'm opposed to this bill because I'm among those Idaho citizens who want smaller and less government, not bigger and more government. I want local control and not state control. I believe it should be left to local governments to manage the libraries they fund through local tax dollars. I also want to make my own decisions for my family regarding materials in public libraries, to do that simply by having a conversation with my local librarian and not have another individual making decisions for me. Parents should have the right to make their own decisions about what their children have access to, but parents should not have the right to make decisions about materials and access to those materials for children that are not their own. I want my state legislators spending their time and my tax dollars on issues that are actually critical to the future of our state, and there are many of those, and not spending time and tax dollars working on a problem that simply doesn't exist. Our libraries are not repositories for obscene or pornographic materials, and any parent who wants to can already restrict access to any materials for their child simply by being involved in what their child is reading. Idahoans don't need the legislature making those decisions for them. This bill would allow any individual who thinks their child, quote, may be adversely affected, end quote, buy a book, to set in motion a time-consuming and expensive process that ultimately would result not just in a cause of action or judicial injunction, but could have expenses so high the library might have to close. I am an Idahoan who sees this bill as just another example of government overreach, which allows one individual to limit the freedoms and rights of other individuals. I see the bill as a waste of time by addressing a made-up problem that does not exist. We simply don't have pornographic materials in our libraries. I ask you to please vote no on advancing this bill out of committee and go to work on bills that address the many problems we have in this state. Thank you for allowing my testimony.
Thank you for your testimony. Kayla Dodson. Welcome to committee. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you. My name is Kayla Dodson and I'm a resident of Boise, Idaho. I'm here representing myself in opposition, surprise, to Senate Bill 1289. I get it. Adults want to protect children. We can get very uncomfortable when the topic of sex comes up. What is normal, healthy childhood sexual development? What are the responsibilities of parents and caregivers? What are the responsibilities of all adults in the community? I think that's what Senate Bill 1289 is about, trying to address this. In my opinion, and an opinion apparently of a lot of others, public libraries and libraries in our public schools do an excellent job of providing comprehensive collections of media materials to meet the wide range of community needs. It is the parents' responsibility to oversee and nurture healthy childhood sexual development. Sexuality is more than just sex. It's emotional, social, cultural, and physical. Parents, not librarians, should monitor their children's library choices as they should their TV choices, their movies, videos, music, websites, social media, etc. Please vote no on Senate Bill 1289. I stand for questions.
Thank you for your testimony this morning, Ms. Dodson. I don't see any. Thank you.
Thank you.
That was some of the testimony in the Senate State Affairs Committee Monday on Senate Bill 1289. The committee passed the new bill from Republican Senator Jeff Schroeder of Mountain Home. Republican Representative Jerome Crane of Nampa pulled his earlier bill from the House floor and worked with Republican Senator Jeff Schroeder of Mountain Home on a new bill that includes elements of his bill, including that parents or minors can pursue a lawsuit against a library district or school district for $250 damages if they or their offspring receive material deemed harmful. That's much less than the $2,500 damages that could have been awarded under last year's bill, which Governor Brad Little vetoed. The new bill defines material as harmful to minors if they include nudity, sexual conduct, sexual excitement, or sadomasochistic abuse when it, quote, appeals to the prurient interest of minors as judged by the average person applying contemporary community standards, unquote, and when depictions are, quote, patently offensive to prevailing standards in the adult community with respect to what is suitable material for minors, unquote. Bill supporters claim there is pornographic material in school and public libraries accessible to minors in Idaho, something librarians around the state deny. Senate Bill 1289 now goes to the Senate floor. You're tuned into the KRFP Evening Report for Friday, the 16th of February. We have one last news story. Sandpoint police arrested David C. Bowman of Sandpoint for the second time in the past 3 weeks for allegedly trespassing at Bonner County Commissioners meetings. Prosecutors this week charged Bowman with a first offense for failure to depart the Bonner County Administrative Building during a meeting where he seemed to be disruptive. Since January 26th, Bonner County Commission Chair Luke Omot had twice arrested Bowman under citizen's arrest authority with the help from the Sandpoint Police Department. January 26th was the first time Bowman was arrested, and February 6th was the second arrest. In January, Omot trespassed Bowman from county commissioners' meetings for 1 year, saying Bowman disrupted several meetings and sent threatening emails. Bowman continued to attend meetings. Following the second arrest, police submitted a probable cause affidavit, which detailed Bowman's refusal to heed Omot's request to vacate the premises a number of times and ignoring several police requests as well. The spokesman review reports Bonner County Prosecutor Lewis Marshall said police released Bowman with no charges in the January incident, and he avoided jail the second time on February 6th because there was no probable cause affidavit or warrant. In an email, Marshall said he has not yet made a determination whether to hand the case over to a special prosecutor. Well, that's it for the KRFP Evening Report for tonight. Taking a look at the weather forecast for the Moscow Pullman area. Mostly clear tomorrow with a high of 40. Saturday night, 80% chance of rain and snow, mainly after 4 a.m. Snow level 2,900 feet, low 32. New snow accumulation less than half an inch. And on Sunday, 80% chance of rain and snow. Snow level 3,100 feet, rising to 3,700 feet in the afternoon. High 38, new snow accumulation less than half an inch possible. Currently 28 degrees. If you want to help KRFP keep newscasts like this on the air, plus the newscasts you hear during Morning Mix, the recordings of local events and the public affairs shows, plus the music and arts programming you hear every day on KRFP, be sure to become a member of KRFP. Memberships are $35 a year, $20 for students and low income. You can mail your memberships to KRFP, 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. Or you can go to the KRFP website to find out more ways to help KRFP. There's a drop-down box there that says Support KRFP. There you can underwrite programming, which is a cost-effective way of letting our listeners know your business supports community radio. You can also adopt a DJ. There's a PayPal option and a Patreon button as well. Also on the website, you can stream KRFP or listen to the two-week archives of radio shows broadcast on KRFP. I'm Lee Robartis. Jim Roach assisted with tonight's newscast. Have a pleasant weekend. This is KRFP Moscow Pullman, community radio for the Palouse at 90.3 on your FM dial and online.
KRFP Community Radio is proudly supported by Ponderosa Rentals, providing quality home rentals since 2006.